for Camacho Negron, like Edwin Cortez, Alberto Rodriguez, Carlos Torres, Adolfo Mato, Elisam Escobar, Aidan Beltran, and Solis.
Hi, everybody. This is Eric Mann with my co-host, Tammy Liu. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM. We call this the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. I'm going to be on in 1 second with Grace Lee Boggs, but I just want to do another short promo. The Strategy Center, of which we're participants, Tammy and myself, as well as you've heard Manuel Criollo and Cynthia Rojas and Damon Ozzoli. We're having our own annual political party on this Saturday, May 1st, at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock p.m., at the Radisson Wilshire Hotel in New York, in L.A. And if you're interested in getting tickets, which are $50, call us up at 213-387-2800, because what I'm really struck by here about the importance of KPFK allowing us to have the show is there's a lot of ageism in the world where a lot of people might think, well, Yuri Kochiyama is interesting. I know she's in her 80s. Grace Lee Boggs, she's, as you're going to get to, is very interesting. She's in her 80s. Richie Perez just died at 59. Panama Alba is probably turning 60. I've just turned 60. That we're not just trying to keep some of these people alive in terms of some vague, like we're in the archives. A lot of us, we still think we're in the vanguard. We still think that we're on the front lines. You know, in fact, I'm just about old enough to get into the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party in about 5 years. So in that context, I bring on our next feisty voices from the front lines, the amazing Grace Lee Boggs. Grace has been a writer, an activist, a public speaker. In terms of one interesting theme, she also comes out of both the Asian Pacific Islander movement, the women's movement, but with very, very strong ties to the Black Liberation Movement, partially through her long-time partnership with her late husband, James Boggs, whose book, Racism and the Class Struggle, totally turned my head around in terms of the centrality of the Black Liberation Movement. And Grace is doing some amazing frontline work now in Detroit. Grace, nice to have you on the show.
Good to talk to you, Eric. It was good to hear Yuri also, to hear her so strong. I just got her book, as a matter of fact, passing it on. I couldn't put it down.
Me neither. Me neither. It's pretty amazing, huh?
Really. Really. Now, you know, one of the things I was thinking about as folks are talking about failure and success and so forth, you know, when you talk about revolution and revolutionary struggle, it's not a question of failure or success. It's a dialectic development. It's a recognition that you can't get to the absolute like a shot out of the pistol, that we have to learn from every experience. We have to remember that Lenin was born in 1770, you know, and that Du Bois was born in 1868. I mean, it's just amazing when you think of all that has transpired since that time.
And absolutely. And one question I have for you is, when was the first time, I read your important biography, Living for Change, which is another book folks got to get, and thanks to Amazon, whether you like it or not, you just say the title and say the author and folks will be able to find it, Grace Lee Boggs, Living for Change, an autobiography. When was the moment when, because as I remember you went to a privileged school as I did, when was the moment that the light bulb went on, that you broke with traditional liberalism and began to think of yourself as a revolutionary? What was the idea and what was the event?
The event was the March on Washington movement projected by A. Philip Randolph in 1941 to demand jobs for blacks in defense industries, and the recognition of what could be achieved by a movement even though the march itself did not take place. The way in which the threat, the mere threat of 50,000, 100,000 blacks marching on Washington in the midst of this attempt to start the war, you know, to get into the war in Europe, forced Roosevelt to issue Executive Order 8002. And it was just transformed the country and it transformed my life. I began to see what can happen when people who have been oppressed begin to get into motion. And that's what started it. That was before even I met Jimmy Boggs. But, you know, I want to say that more than 60 years have transpired since then, and I think that today we are in a stage of crisis that we have never been in before, and that the dangers and the opportunities are enormous, because what we're facing are questions that are so basic, so fundamental, and that touch the essence of what it is to be a human being. I mean, the questions of global warming, the questions of work, jobless recovery, the question of education. What does it mean to educate somebody rather than, just to pour facts into their head? And what do we do in relationship to the rest of the world at this point when we become so isolated, when this country has become so isolated, and when we are likely to live in terror for the rest of our lives until we begin facing what has happened with globalization. With globalization, which is not just, it is capitalism run rampant, but what it's done in terms of the rest of the world, in terms of the inequality that is established, in terms of the kind of structural adjustment that has been imposed upon other nations, and the crises into which these other nations have been forced. I mean, we are at such an opportune time, and the United States is in such a mess, that we really have to think about how are we thinking about revolution these days?
Well, I have some thoughts, but to start with, how are you thinking about revolution, Grace? What are some of the new conditions making you maybe reevaluate the form and strategy and direction of revolution?
Well, you asked me when the light bulb first went on, and I told you about the March on Washington movement in 1941. The next time the light bulb went on was 1967, when all hell broke loose in Detroit and in New Jersey, and then again after Martin Luther King's assassination, which, by the way, is, 1968, it's 36 years.
That's right.
Yesterday. The light bulb that went on was that up to that time, Jimmy and I had been in the radical movement for nearly 20 years, but we had never made the distinction, more than 20 years, we'd never made the distinction between rebellion and revolution. And when the people came, young people came pouring out into the streets with all their resistance to the injustice, and yet we're not able to sustain it, then the question arose, what is the difference? What is a rebellion? See, up to that time, I think, and most Marxist-Leninists had thought of that if you could just get the masses in motion, they were organized and disciplined by the very process of capitalist production. That was what the workers were. So all you had to do was to get rid of the integument, the capitalist integument, and this new society would emerge. And I see that it doesn't happen that way, that we have to begin creating alternatives and then take advantage of the opportunity which will come to take the power, that we can't think of taking the power first. Because after you take the power, you are faced with all the questions that the old society was, plagued with. And so I think we have to think anew about what revolution is. And I think that King, before he died, in the last couple of years of his life, is really helping us to understand how it requires that revolution has to be very radical. It has to be very radical in terms of the values that it stands for. And how we take those values and begin creating positive change and get people thinking about positive change and using their imaginations, that's our challenge today. Because the crisis is here for the bourgeoisie. The United States is making Iraq safe for terrorism.
Well, on that, let me add two things that you might want to engage. I mean, I think one problem is that I don't think that Marxist-Leninists thought that when the capitalist integument was gotten out of the way, that there would be a free ride towards revolution. I think that Lenin argued pretty early that if you don't build a party, if you don't build a correct form of organization, a disciplined form of organization, as well as a participatory one, that people, that a rebellion will be beat down by the state. I think
he built on Marx's ideas with regard to the working class. He started doing that immediately by 1895. And then he began to think, to create the idea of the party in 1903 and what is to be done.
Right.
And then, but by the time he got to take power, he began to see the enormous challenge of making the Cultural Revolution after you take power. And he could see the Russian state drifting towards state capitalism. And he began to ask a whole lot of questions. He began to ask, how do you begin to get the workers and the peasants actually engaged? How do you get them to participate? He began to see that the Soviet form was not enough.
I agree with that. I do agree with that, and I think that the question of the constant dilemma of how to form a party, how to build a movement, how to have a so-called cultural revolution within it, and yet how not to blow up the very institution that you need. Because let's segue to a different point that I think you and I are also very interested in. I'm very concerned that the United States is making terrorism the only form of rebellion that will be possible in the 21st century. We just came back from a so-called free election in El Salvador. We witnessed how the Arena Party, in conjunction with Noriega and other members of the State Department, threatened the people of El Salvador so much that they told them if they voted for the FMLN, essentially the United States would, you know, withdraw the remittances, would mess with their immigration status, and basically, if necessary, overthrow Shafiq, just like they did Allende. So if the United States bombs 3 million people in Vietnam, if it kills Allende, if it prevents a free election in El Salvador, what does it mean when people begin to say that the only thing they can't control is small groups of 5, 10, and 15, 20 people, not even under a centralized command, but under a centralized strategy, developing tactical nuclear weapons, possibly germ warfare, blowing up trains? The socialist movement has never been interested in terrorism. But if, in fact, the United States makes socialism literally impossible, does it not make terrorism necessary?
Well, you know, the point is, we shouldn't expect them to make socialism possible. We're the ones who have to make it possible. Let me give you an example of what I mean. I've just come from an environmental justice climate change conference. It was wonderful. I imagine you know Tom Goldtooth. He was there.
Sure, sure.
The president of the Indigenous Peoples Network. But what the Native Americans have done is they have begun to create wind power as a basis for resolving global warming. And they've gone about it very beautifully. They were able to get a grant from the Department of Energy to build this turbine in the Rosebud, on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. They were able to get arrangements to be on the federal grid. They were able to get purchases, I mean get market, so they were ready to set up. And they made an estimate of what's possible in the northern plains to supply half of all the energy that is used by the United States currently. And what they're doing is they're proposing a way to solve the environmental crisis. And by doing so, they're giving hope and they're establishing a road to the future. And that's what I think is required for revolutionists. Because one of the reasons why we have no movement is people have no hope. They don't know where we're going.
Well, what would be your proposal to get the 2 million people out of the U.S. prisons without a more direct, aggressive assault on the prison system?
Well, that's not what I think is necessary. You know, it's life. We have to be very careful not to think like Bush, you know, that there's some simple answer. I just heard Bush. It's incredible how simplistic he is. There is no simple answer to the prison system. What we have to understand is that the prison system is the result of the educational system. What the educational system is still today, 100 years later, it's still a factory system. It's still a command and control system. It's still a system that creates certain elites and throws away half the population. And that half the population ends up on the streets. They drop out of school. They're pushed out of school. And they end up in prison. So it's not a question of getting them out of prison. It's a question of getting to the educational system and changing that along the lines of freedom schooling so that young people are being developed from kindergarten on as socialist individuals, in fact.
But let me ask you this, because our organization does have a program called Stop the Pre-Prisons, and we're talking about a community rights campaign. Even if the kids are not educated, and even if the kids are not educated as socialists, do they deserve to be rounded up on anything from spinners?
No, they don't deserve. I mean, but you must not expect justice from capitalism.
I don't.
Just capitalism is inherently unjust. It organizes and structures all its institutions to create injustice.
Okay.
So we're the ones who have to take advantage of the crisis that there is in the schools right now to reject another way of schooling.
Absolutely. But you would support movements to demand freeing the overwhelming majority of prisoners right now, wouldn't you?
No, I would not. Because I don't see, first of all, I don't see it succeeding. And secondly, I don't see it getting to the roots of things. What we have, particularly, say, in a city like Detroit, Los Angeles may not be so bad, but we've had a homicide almost every single day since the first of the year. And this comes from young people who are hopeless.
Okay, so our view, just to be clear, is our view would be that, yes, there's a homicide every day, and we would still support the freeing of the overwhelming majority of people.
What we need are forms of restorative justice rather than punitive justice. That we have to begin to see how we can do what indigenous peoples used to do, what communities used to do, reintegrate people who are social offenders into the community.
Well, this
and,
is...
And they did that because they didn't have places to put all these folks. So we have them, or we have had the money to build all these prisons.
I'm going to have to let you got the last word. As always, this is Eric Mann. I've been on the phone with Grace Lee Boggs, as you see, running on at least 8 cylinders, although I'm sure it's a hybrid engine you're using, Grace. And we'd like to thank our engineer, Maggie LaPique, our producer, Alan Minsky, my co-host, Tammy Bang Lu, Yuri Kochiyama, amazing interview, Panama Alba from the Young Lords, and to give our love and memories to Richie Perez of the Young Lords Party, who gave his life for the revolution, a revolution that every single participant in today's show has tried to continue.
Been listening to the 4 o'clock report. It's Public Affairs with Eric Mann and Tammy Lu on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond. Coming up next is Beneath the Surface with Monday's host Susie Weisman. Don't go away.